So hello everyone. Welcome to our session where we'll be talking about experiences collected in the first attempts working with big data on behalf of the Microsoft. My name is Alexey Haleka. I'm program manager in the Azure Customer Advisory team. So belonging to the part of engineering and based in Europe, actually in Germany. And here's my colleague Olivia.
Yeah, hi, I'm Olivia Klose. I'm a technical evangelist at Microsoft in Germany and mostly focusing on Microsoft Azure and anything to do with big data.
So in order to set up the expectation for you for this session, we'll not be teaching here Hadoop. There's a lot of materials in the internet. You can read about what is the classical Hadoop, how to work with this, all the best practices, and et cetera. Rather, we will focus on telling the stories, what we learned from engaging with customers in end-to-end solution right from the beginning to the end, and starting from things like how we were choosing platform, HD Insight, or Hadoop, going through big data, classical big data questions, do I have a big data problem or I don't, what to do with this stuff, and I'll be mentioning or tell all our gotchas we collected through the engagements based on a couple of customers' engagements we'll be talking about them. So basically what we want you to understand here is how to approach this problem rather than teach you how to use Hadoop, right, the Hive queries or Tick queries, and et cetera. So the first question is...
So we've done a couple of customer engagements, and most customer engagements on big data actually start off with, hi, I have big data, so how shall we get started? So Alexey, how do we get started? I have big data.
Well, when you ask me in this way, I remind the book, very cool book, by the way, I read as I was a little younger, Jerome K. Jerome Free, The Man in the Boat. And the story here was about the main character of the book. He went to the British Museum, found one of the medical books, started reading symptoms. He was suffering from like a couple of weeks trying to understand how to cure this disease. And then he just started like going through the book, looking at other diseases, comparing symptoms, what he thought he was experiencing with other diseases, and it turned out to be like he has nearly entire book of sicknesses in his body, right? So the same story I observe when we talk about like customers calling like, I have a big data problem, often it's very similar to this story as well. People assume they have a big data problem, although this term is overutilized, right? A lot of people understand different thing about what the big data problem is. And it is not necessarily, or it is often, some customers really trying to move the pain of having like not very performant data warehouse, thinking like, oh, if I move it everything into Hadoop, everything will start magically work. In reality, if like for example, if you remember or if you saw it today, Microsoft introduced the I think it's called Microsoft Band, right? The new smartwatch. And one of the things, if you read the announcement, one of the things where the VP is talking about is related to the big data, because this device is going to collect a lot of information about your health condition, about your sport activities, about everything like cholesterol ratio and et cetera, and it's all going to be collected somewhere. But the big question is, what do you really do about that?
So what you mean is big data is central to everything, and you just gather all the data, just like, so I'm more of a visual type of person, so I usually take the analogy of a dam, or a lot of people nowadays talk about the data lake. So you collect everything, so you collect all the water, and then later on the questions will be asked. So generating all the insights, or in the analogy of the dam, you will generate the electricity out of the water much later as it is demanded, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, I understand. But I still believe that I have a big data problem. So let's get down to business.
You mean how do you start?
Yeah, how do we get started?
Okay, so over the years, I was doing many, and I was focusing on the data warehousing problems, right? And the good thing about data warehouse solutions was what we had more or less well-documented and structured approach how you address the problem or how you build it, right? So first of all, you recognize there's a demand for having some data warehouse solution. Then you look at the pretty much well-documented types of the architectures you can apply. Nice. Then you decide like how you're going to load the data, what data sources you have, how you're going to load it. Then once you load it, you need to do something with your data. Often it's a question like removing duplicate, cleaning data, and et cetera. And then once all well settled, you start running your analytical queries and getting value out of it. And if your data warehouse was experiencing some performance problems, there was a couple of concepts how you can basically scale it up, for example, get your data warehouse running better. So tuning, validation of the tuning, it was pretty much all well documented. Now the environment's changing a lot. First question, which we just realized could be very difficult to answer is whether I have or I don't the big data problem. Then the next thing comes what to choose as a platform to address this problem. There's Cloudera, Hortonworks, Microsoft, tons of different tools, cloud, not cloud. How do I code it? Or like where do I store my data? Blob storage, if we speak of the cloud, like blob storage table, in which formats, CSV files or XML files, whatever. Then one. This can also impact the decision, like how do I pre-process my data? So how do I get it to the tools which will be running some analytics on that? Which analytical tools to use? And then the last but not least, and I think the most important question, like all the ideas, all the thoughts I made before, how do I validate all this stuff? Like whether it will be delivering me expected performance, answers, and et cetera. And like if you look at this picture, this is pretty much, this car, this is like about like 10 or a little bit more years older than me. There was no electronic there at all, except like, I mean, the lights and ignition, et cetera, but no intellectual things in there. But if you look at the modern cars, and we worked with, this is one of the customer scenarios we will be referring to. Unfortunately, both customer scenarios, they are still in progress. Therefore, we are not allowed to unveil the name. But I can tell you this is one of the very famous German car manufacturer. So therefore, what we saw there, the traditional car is not, none of these electric cars or hybrid, traditional car has about 1 gigabyte of the software running inside the car. About 12,000 type of errors collected in the very basic configuration. Something about like 2,000 or something user functions, like, and it's also not taking navigation system into consideration, like suspension, brakes, all the intellectual things. When like start the engine and you see your it's time to replace the brakes, this is where it's coming from.
A fun fact about this one, as you mentioned, 1 gigabyte of car software. So there's this site called informationisbeautiful.com. And there's a nice diagram which displays how many millions lines of code there is in certain softwares. So with big data, you always think of the Large Hadron Collider that is collecting about like 15 petabytes of data, I think, accumulated over a year. And this one has about 50 million lines of code. Interestingly enough, car software typically has about 100 million lines of code.
So 50 versus 100 million, yeah. It's pretty much fascinating how big is it. Yeah, and so you need to multiply all this information what the customer has worldwide presence, a lot of dealers, and every time your car goes through the checkup or you come into any of the repair shops, this information will be read and then delivered back to the car manufacturer. And of course, marketing wants to get the use out of it. Right, like example I worked on is based on brake analytics. So basically, you wouldn't believe me how much information brake sensors and this intellectual model which collects the information about brakes can tell about you. First of all, it tells about how fast you're accelerating and how hard you're pressing the pedals, right, when you need to stop at the red light or whatever. Second, it can recognize whether it's you driving, or in case if you're a man, then how is your whether it's your wife driving, because then the style of driving changes a lot. And all this information collected. So, and the marketing thought of like, okay, why don't we look inside this data and make recommendation to the customers. It's not about when to replace the brakes, but rather saying like, okay, you are not that aggressive driver, we can offer you a little bit more green type of brakes, rather like if I'm driving pretty much fast, right, and my brakes gets like recycled pretty much often, so therefore for me they probably would offer something more robust and like appropriate for my style of driving. And you would think like, okay, cool, let's just analyze this information, because all the data about your car get ported into XML files. This is cool. The XML file we can read. There's a lot of intelligence in the world, like how to analyze the data stored in the XML file. The problem is what each car manufacturer has number of sensors which can be put in the car dependent like on the release, before facelift and after facelift and et cetera. Therefore, the version of this sensor which you have in your car may be different. It can be own built by the car manufacturer. It can be like by one of the biggest other manufacturers like Bosch and et cetera. How does it impact your solution? In fact, it impacts quite a lot, because then the standard, how this information gets stored, will look different. So you will have problems. You cannot apply, like in the case of data warehousing, very rigid way of translating the data. You have to really understand how your XML, which XML structure you're talking to. And interestingly enough, this XML file, which was collecting entire car information, including all the errors and et cetera, it was developed over the years. And if you ask the car manufacturer, like, and what is the schema of the data, they will not help you, because the schema got lost over the years. So therefore, the process of extracting this data, and this is how they came to the big data solution, because their classical data warehouse was struggling with just simply ETLing data into the data warehouse and before asking any question, right? So that's how they thought they will rather store it in the raw XML format, and then with try and error, recognize which patterns and which analytics can they retrieve out of there. Another problem is kind of classical scenario, e-shopping, e-commerce solution or e-commerce platform. It's a very known platform in Europe, and what they did is a solution to recommend it for somebody like Olivia in this age, right? So if you log into the site and you start go shopping, they push the advertisement which is suited for you particularly based on your previous purchase patterns and on how they built the recommendation engine. So they compare your behavior with behavior of other users who did the same. You probably saw something similar as Amazon. When you go and start shopping there, they also start like saying, person who bought this also looked into this and et cetera. So how the recommendation engine works in detail, we've got like user logged in and like browsing the web page, right? Once you logged in, there is information already about who you are, what's your previous purchasing story, and then this gets stored, every activity what you do on the website, it gets stored in integrations, in IIS, Internet Information Service. Then the logs on the badge gets processed with some engine into the table storage and get converted, so the information about user experience get extracted into the blob, so the rest just gets ignored. Right, and then there is a piece running in HD Insight in the cloud, which does all the analytics, similarity matrix creation, and etc. We'll be talking about how it's built a little bit in the later slides. And then all the speed get the similarity matrix, which is just simple, the simplest SQL table what you can imagine, gets loaded in SQL Azure database. And so your behavior online gets compared to the similarity matrix. And based on the matches, you will get product recommendations in real time shown on your web page, like as a recommendation what you have to or what you can look at next. Right? So, but speaking of all these cases, the very first question which we were getting, what platform to work with and what to rely on, right? So what kind of tools to select?
Exactly. So we have just covered that we actually have a big data problem, and now we want to get started with some technologies. And then we figured out that there's literally the agony of choice. Can you see that in the back? Yeah, exactly, that's my point. Basically, there's a huge variety of companies that actually are involved or contributing to the big data landscape in some way or the other. And the other message that I want to share with you in this one is that with big data, there's much more to than just data warehouse. There's also the infrastructure analytics part or visualization. So this actually shows that it's really difficult to get started with big data in general. And in Germany, there's the saying that many roads or many ways lead to Rome. In other words, there's more than one way of doing big data. Nonetheless, nowadays, a lot of people think that you only do big data if you have deployed Hadoop, which is actually not the case. Hadoop is actually just covering one aspect of big data, as you can see. So Hadoop is really good if you have poorly structured data and want to process all this data in one batch. But if you want to do data processing in real time, as in streaming, then Hadoop may not necessarily be the best option. Yeah, Hadoop has Storm, and Storm is also on public preview on HD Insight on Azure, but this might not necessarily be the best choice. So let's get started with a couple of questions that we have covered or that we have encountered as we wanted to do big data. So the first question usually is like, well, do I do this on-premise or in the cloud? And generally speaking, if you have data born on-premise, then you might as well just do this all on-premise. So you can install Hadoop on Windows Server or on Linux, but then you can also leverage the benefits of the cloud and therefore move it to the cloud as well. And with cloud, obviously, if you have cloud-born data, you might as well just stay in the cloud, such as with IIS logs or Clickstream Analytics. Let's assume that we are going for the cloud, and then there are obviously a couple of alternatives that you can use once you're in the cloud. You can go for Azure or AWS. Since we are on a Microsoft event, we might as well just settle on Azure for now. And then the next question, if you're on Azure and you want to, let's assume that we want to go for Hadoop after all. There are two options. You can go for the platform as a service solution, which would be HD Insight. We will go into this more detail later on. Or you can go for the infrastructure as a service solution, which would be Hadoop on Azure. So you can use, or you can create virtual machines on Azure where you can even choose between Windows and Linux, which would be the next question. Which platform do you choose, Windows or Linux? And once you actually settle on one operating system, once you settle on Windows, you've pretty much settled or decided on the other questions, such as C#, .NET, or Java. So once you settle on Windows, you pretty much go for developer tools in C# and .NET, and usually would go for Microsoft software. Whereas on the other side, if you go for the Linux operating system, you pretty much go for Java as a development tool or development language and other open source software such as Hive, Pig, and Mahout. For now, we are covering HD Insight versus Hadoop on Azure. So there are two different deployment options in Azure. So on the one side, HDInsight, as I said, platform as a service, which is really easy to use. Especially if you don't have any infrastructure skills, you might as well just provision one on demand. And once you don't actually use or need your HDInsight cluster, you can easily just delete it. And without harming your data at all, because the data is all stored in blob storage, which is the key difference between HDInsight and Hadoop. In Hadoop, it's mainly based on HDFS, as in Hadoop Distributed File System, but on Azure, it's all stored in the Azure Blob Storage, which pretty much has the same functionality because it's also replicating three times. On the other side, you can do Hadoop on Azure, as in the infrastructure as a service solution. So you can choose between Windows or Linux. And yeah, you can deploy or provision Linux VMs on Azure. So you have the choice between SUSE, CentOS, and Ubuntu.
Actually, I see you're pushing too much for Linux. You can use also IIS VMs based on Windows installed, then Hortonworks distribution on Windows as well. But very interesting question what Olivia was mentioning here, what HDInsight is a good scenario for when you need to provision compute power on demand. And this is this e-commerce platform what I was mentioning was very likened in this approach, because basically what they do, they process IIS logs in the batch, like in the midnight or whatever, classical solution, right? And then they provision HDInsight cluster once the file's there, and then they run some analytics and they shut down the cluster. So in this way, you can minimize the financial impact of your solution. So you pay less, you just get your compute power on demand when you need it, and fine, right? So, but this brings a lot of questions related to how do I automate this stuff? Like, I need to run it daily, right? So what, every time when the log's there, I need to provision cluster, and I want to think of automation of this process. So, first of all, what you need to know if you want to provision HDInsight cluster, the tool set what you'll be using for this is PowerShell. So you have to be familiar with PowerShell cluster. Second thing what you need to know is default file system for HDInsight, and contrary to other Hadoop distribution in so-called WASP, so which is Windows Azure Blob Storage, right? And not your local file system. Actually, in all deployments and all tunings, every time we saw what customer was using local storage for storing data or whatever, we were recommending move away. So store everything what is important for your workload to run in the blob storage. In terms of Hadoop, in terms of how HDInsight sees the, or what's the difference between local and remote storage, like Azure storage, there's no big difference. So the commands and batches gets executed exactly the same way as if it's stored locally. And there is tons of example, and one here I mentioned in particular, like how to take basically a PowerShell script and provision your HDInsight cluster. There are a couple of tools coming in to help you automate in all this process, and we will be talking about it's either Azure Data Factory or Azure Automation. So if you look into, in contrary, if you look into what do I do if I want to mimic like existing solution, for example, run on premise, you want to move it in the cloud, and you rely on Linux or Windows based installation of the Hadoop cluster, but in the cloud, the various variety of the questions which you have to consider before you run into this solution. First of all, every VM has limited size of data storage what you can attach to this. So right now, the biggest VM can connect to 16 Azure blob storages and have correspondingly about 16 terabyte of data per VM. So that means what your each cluster node will have maximum size of 16 terabyte, and you cannot overcome this limit. Although you have flexibility, to choose which SKU you want to use, like how many cores, how much memory, and et cetera. So in HD Insight, on contrary, once you decide for that, you don't have impact of how many cores will be running on the on each of the nodes in case of HD Insight. So you need to balance between how many tweaks and buttons you want to have to control your solution versus like fully automated but less controlled by your environment. Then another thing is how do you monitor this stuff? HD Insight provides pretty much rich tools for monitoring how the cluster runs. Good. In your situation, if you build your own cluster configuration based on the VMs, you need to think about how do you keep track of every node, what is the execution there, like how the query runs there, memory, configuration settings, and et cetera. In terms of automating deployment, a colleague of us, Lara Rubek and Mushed Zaman, they worked on the creating GitHub project, this one. So you can just go download their example and adjust it for you. But basically, everything except automated deployment then is up to you. You control how your cluster will run, and you need to think of how do you monitor all this stuff. Coming back to HD Insight, this is as straightforward as you see. Just one cmdlet in PowerShell. You say create new cluster. Mention your subscription. Of course, if you want to run it closer to you, you need to specify location and the stuff like how many nodes do you want to have, and you have flexibility to decide how many storage counts you attach to it. So in HD Insight, there is no limit on how many storage counts can be connected, so you can scale unlimitedly your solution, which is cool. What if you need to tweak this stuff? What if you need to adjust like this e-commerce platform? The guys told us, you know, we know what we need to have not more than four mappers running on each of the compute nodes. How can we control it? In classical Hadoop, you would go to the configuration files like core XML, then HDFS, map red sites, and you will tweak your settings like with regards of how much memory you get to per mapper, how much memory you get per reducer, how many mappers you run, right? In case of this company, they are provisioning about four HD Insight clusters, each run about 70 to 75 nodes. That means that once you provision that, you need, and you want to do changes on the provision configuration, you need to go to each individual node and change it, which is like 4 multiplied by 70 and multiplied by number of times you need to log in to remote machine and change settings and restart so that the setting gets applied. Pretty much not very favorable work, right? It will take you quite a long. Question then, is there a better way of doing that? Actually, so I wanted to say, like, you can also manage the Hive. So there's one. PowerShell has ability to pass some configuration tweaks to your cluster settings. Like, for example, whether you want to use compression on your storage or not, whether how many mappers you want to run, if you want to have extra storage attached to this or not. So this is all documented, it's available on MSDN, you just need to go look at the article there and you'll be fine. So the thing is, why is this important? Because instead of changing your configuration settings on each individual node in the running HD Insight cluster, it is way more efficient, just shut it down and rerun provisioning with the new settings. You will spend a few minutes on reprovisioning cluster instead of going and tweaking it on each individual node. And again, this is all pretty much well documented. Now, there's one guy you need to pay attention of. What we used in this scenario, we used Uzi for controlling the workflow because the workflow consists of number of Hive and Pig jobs. Like Hive was extracting data into some tables and then storing it as output. Pig was used to clean data and create like slicing and dicing, basically, right? So creating particular slices of the customer use, like, for example, women recent purchases, men recent purchases, then dealers or companies who are buying from this website as well, and etc. So for all this analytics. And Uzi is pretty much powerful tool in organizing sequences of the task that you want to execute on your cluster. The thing, though, with Uzi is it's not configured by default. So once you provision it inside cluster, it has kind of default settings which don't apply necessarily to the configuration what you run, in sense like where's your data stored, like what is your default storage. And therefore, you need to go and adjust those settings manually if you want to use Uzi. Right, and another thing about saying about this on-demand provisioning of the Edge Insight cluster, every time you provision the cluster, you lose, if you store, for example, Uzi controls the workloads, right? So they call some peaks and Hive scripts, which is nice, but every time you shut down the cluster, it will be lost. So you need to think about how to persist this information so that every time you set up the new configuration, the scripts are there. So therefore, what we recommend is instead of storing files locally on C drive or whatever, go and store it in the blob storage. So you will be generating the blob storage attached to Edge Insight cluster anyway, so just go store your scripts there. So every time when the cluster gets reprovisioned, you don't have problem to copy scripts and control like whether they're there or not, right? So another thing is automation. How do I achieve this? Like every day, start to provision the cluster, execute your workload, and good. Let's move ahead and do some analytics and then shut down it. The way they did it first was they used Windows Server on-site, so on-premise in their infrastructure, where they just used a classical Windows scheduler. Cool. Okay, so they built a number of PowerShell scripts. The Windows scheduler was kicking off PowerShell execution, so to provision Edge Insight cluster. Once the Edge Insight cluster was provisioned, the Uzi was configured. Uzi, once it was configured, was kicking off the execution of Peak and Hive scripts. All was controlled nicely. And then the output was stored in the SQL Azure database. And afterwards, it was all shut down. Couple of questions come in here. What if your Windows cluster, because it's not highly available, right? Once if it goes down? Second, what happens if I lose connection between my infrastructure to the cloud? So basically, you cannot provision the cluster, which is, in this particular case, is not that critical, but you may have different workload where not executing the task may lead to some business consequences, right? So another couple of challenges here. What if you run your PowerShell script is not getting executed successfully? How do you monitor all these errors, right? Then, I don't know, troubleshooting Uzi or peak job execution. Like, what if Uzi failed for whatever reason? Where do you control, where do you look for the sources of information which can help you looking into this? So we were able, with the feature which is in the preview now, we were able to address a couple of questions, at least related to the availability. There is a tool called Azure Automation, which is nothing else, just PowerShell daemon running in the cloud, and you can move your PowerShell scripts in the cloud. It's a simple version of how the tool works, right? If you want to understand how it works better, so then go and look at the Azure.com, or how it's called, WindowsAzure.com, right? And you'll see a lot of interest there and also examples. But the thing is, in this case, Azure is taking care of availability of the PowerShell execution, right? So it won't go down. You can run your provisioning scripts out of there. All is cool. Couple of questions still stay. Like, how do I control whether my Uzi failed, if my Uzi job failed, why it failed, and etc. We'll come back to this on the topic called validation of your scenario. And so moving forward, there's another thing which was introduced right before our session here called Azure Data Factory. The Azure Data Factory is a tool which allows you to abstract from the PowerShell script, because the concept of Azure Data Factory, it is the tool which allows you to run classical type of workloads. For example, copy file job. This is what we do in this e-commerce platform scenario, right? They get the IIS logs copied into a GeneSight cluster. Cluster can be provisioned. They call it like on-demand cluster provision in job. They can run in parallel. This is where the Uzi may have struggle with. If you need to execute some task in parallel, or you need to have dependencies between some tasks, so one task does not start before the previous has not finished, right? So ADF allows you to control the stuff more. It can, through the Azure portal, tell you if job failed, why it failed, on which step, and etc. So if you look at the example of what the customer did, and we're still working on it, it's not yet in the production, but here's the concept. You get files stored in JSON format in the blob storage, right? This is your input data. Then the ADF, so Azure Data Factory, takes this data and then runs number of sequence jobs, because they have to be executed in this order. And if we reach the particular step where it can split into parallel processes, it can do it for you as well. It can run the execution in parallel. And couple of concepts here. ADF talks about table and ADF activity. So the table is not a table in the sense of Hive or SQL, classical table. It's just a rule which you take and tell, like, for example, my input data has following format. Out of this format, I want to get, like, imagine it's text file, like, structured text file, right? And you say, like, out of customer ID, name, address, and blah, I just need to take customer ID and product name. So the table helps you to define the transformation process, so what data to filter and store into the output. And activity, in terms of activity, it's, as I mentioned, classic number of classical activities what you may run is a copy job, so basically take data from one source to another destination, move it, so then run Hive script, so you don't need to run PowerShell anymore, you don't need to think how to kick off this execution on your HDInsight cluster, rather you say, like, here's my Hive script, I want to execute it against this and this data. Pick script, and there's an interesting thing called custom MapReduce activity. Why is this important? Because this customer generates similarity matrix based on the Mahout script. So Mahout helps generate some output for them. Right, and Mahout is nothing else is another MapReduce process running in your Hadoop cluster, but it does not leverage default MapReduce algorithm, it uses its own. There are other technologies on Hadoop as well, which may benefit from running in MapReduce mode, but they have their own customized MapReduce algorithm. So for all this stuff, which does not fit into what's supported out of the box, it is very easy to put it in the custom task and then get executed. So now, if we understood which platform we want to use and what are the consequences of this decision, another thing what we may think of is, how do I get my data? Basically, classical scenarios, you can use SQL Server, for example, as a data source. You can use table storage, where you store your data. You can use blob storage, or whatever else, like blob storage storing like text files, text inputs, CSV inputs, or XML files, all is fine. So if you talk about SQL, you can use, for example, HiveODBC connector for transferring data from Hive into SQL and backwards, I think. So the Scoop does it for sure. Scoop allows you to connect to the SQL server and read the data out of SQL into Hive, for example. If it is a blob storage, we can think of attaching this blob storage as additional file system element to your HD Insight cluster, which is also cool. There are also ways how you can read data out of table storage into Hive. This is all cool. But then an interesting question comes, this is what we saw in different variety many times, is, okay, if your file, okay, this car manufacturer example, the default size of the car diagnostics is about 5 megabytes. If we talk about the IIS logs, typically those files are around about like 60 or 50 kilobytes. What do you think is better for processing, like as a input for Hive or Peak Job, smaller or bigger size? Any wild guess? I can tell you, it's 4 megabyte is like more or less optimal size for processing data. So therefore, if you have too many small files, and I think you had this problem as well, or?
Yeah, at some point I was, saving one tweet per file. So there were lots and lots of little files, and it took hours to process all of them, as opposed to just concatenating them all.
Do you remember how long did it take you when you concatenated it all together?
A couple of hours, probably. Oh, concatenating?
Yeah, yeah. After you did that, it was several minutes, probably, right?
Yeah.
So the difference is about like several minutes versus number of hours if you don't follow this best practice. So therefore, in this particular case, size does matter. And there is a good trick what one colleague of us has developed for merging small files into big ones before you like push it to execution into Hive or the Peak script. So, but keep in mind, a lot of small files can kill performance of your processing, which is also relevant. Okay, in case if your batch window is pretty much big, it's cool, but if you really worry about how fast can you compute your data and get outputs, this might be very important. So then, okay, we agreed on which technology we use, how big our data inputs are, and et cetera. So then what happens next? So what tools can I use inside Hadoop to analyze my data? And there is a if you're familiar with analysis services, this is, I would say, analogy of analysis services in the open source. Peak, the engine, analytical engine, which you can use to slice and dice your data. Another alternative, and we'll be talking about structure, how it works a little bit later, and another SQL kind of alternative is a Hive. Right, it's very useful when you have large, incrementally growing data where you have no need of editing your data, so you basically add up the content all the time. And it is very similar to the classical scan type of the data warehouse load, right? And uses the syntax of the commands, what you use is very similar to the SQL commands. So storing data is actually one of the, not only where you store, but how you also store data is one of the very significant decision in your process. What we recognize is the process of getting data out of table storage into like further processing was taken several hours. And we started looking into the problem like trying to diagnose why is this happening. And what customer did in this situation, They were storing data in the table storage, and table storage, if you know, it uses like some value which you can provide for the key value for partitioning strategy, right? So, and what they did basically, they took customer ID and defined it as a key, means what every customer ID was creating individual partition. In the background, in Azure, you get like physical entity created for you. Like think of it as an individual table for each individual customer ID. So when you run the query, like select star from all customer IDs in the last day, it was running across number of physical machines, number of tables, and therefore was taken too long. We recommended instead using the hash function of the customer ID and like using modular function to reduce number of partitions what they did. And the improvement here was like from processing in 1.5 hours to 1.5 minutes. So think the, you know, this type of the things, like even before getting to Hadoop itself, can significantly improve your performance if you think about that. Now, so the how the workload looked like, so just a summary here. We stored data in the blob, we used UZI, and now move into an ADF to control the workload. And peak is used for preparing data sets, so basically generating the similarity matrix data inputs. And similarity matrix itself was generated in the Mahout using clustering algorithm. And honestly, it's not my subject. I pass here over to Olivia. She can talk about Mahout a little bit more in depth.
So now on to the fifth question, as in how do I analyze my data? And what was actually wanted? So I think this is pretty much familiar to a lot of people. You're shopping on Amazon or like watching movies on Netflix, and then automatically you have personalized recommendations. So obviously recommendation engine, as we may have heard beforehand, was a very popular demand, or was in popular demand. And then another thing that was typically wanted was a decision tree. So what options are out there? So on the one hand, there's Mahout, and then on the other hand, there's Azure Machine Learning. Obviously, there are many other options as well. Here we are mostly focusing on Mahout. Obviously, Azure Machine Learning is a very cool service. It's really easy to use, and is pretty much like data science for the masses. Has a lot of modules, and then you can extend it with further R scripts and modules, and especially supports collaboration. On the other hand, Mahout is pretty much the machine learning library or machine learning component of Hadoop, is open source and pretty much write your own code. So the thing that you have to note is with open source, it can evolve really quickly. It can change a lot, can change very fast. But then on the other hand, it doesn't really pay attention too much on like backwards compatibility. And yeah, it is by default on HD Insight and is supported. Let's get started with a Mahout demo, and let's run some random forests. But before we go or dig into the demo, let's first cover what are random forests. So one decision tree is a very easy way to classify a collection of certain things. It could be a binary classification, as in like true, false, or it could be a multi-class classification. So if you want to classify a user, there could be a lot of user profiles, profile A, B, C, and D, and so on and so forth. So let's take a very simple example, oranges and bananas, and we could easily classify them according to their shape or color, but just for fun's sake, let's classify them according to their location or according to their coordinates, X and Y axis. And yeah, so you can easily divide them up, as you can see along those lines. So this is one typical decision tree, and a random tree would be where you can randomly place those decision lines. So for instance, the blue line could be also a horizontal one, so along the y-axis as opposed to the x-axis. So this is one random tree, and a random forest is basically a collection of many random trees. And therefore aggregating the result across many of those random trees, and therefore doesn't, is resisting overfitting according overfitting to the training data set. Let's get into the Mahout demo then. And this would take a couple of steps. So first step would be, where does the data have to be? It has to be in a very specific location. Then we will generate a descriptive file. I will go into this later on, why we need a descriptive file. And then we build a random forest. And then finally, we will test the forest or the model by classifying test data or data that has been unknown so far. So this is the Mahout webpage. And let's get started where the data has to be. Okay, first of all, what data do we have? I'm typically using one Azure Blob Storage, Azure Blob Explorer. And these are the two data sets that I'm using. One is called test and the other one training data set. And this was used, or this is publicly available from the UCI repository. I already have it in the following directory called test data, but it actually has to be in the directory /HTTP/ and then whatever you want. So we could copy this by just using this Azure Explorer, or we could copy this using PowerShell, or we could use it like on the HD Insight cluster itself. So here we are in the HD Insight cluster. And just to give you a feel of like the Hadoop shell command. So we can do HDFS for Hadoop Distributed File System, then again DFS for Distributed File System. And then we can list what is already on the store or on the blob storage. And then, we'll see that here you can see that there's the directory called test data and a directory called user. So we want to see what is actually in user, and it actually has to be in user /HTTP. So let's see what is in there. Okay, so suddenly at the moment there is no data yet, or not the test data that we want to use for this demo. So let's just copy them over. So it would be HDFS, DFS, and then copy, but then beforehand, okay, we have to first make the directory test data anyways. So let's first make the directory user HTTP test data. And then copy the files. So it would be test data KDD train plus to user HTTP test data. And then obviously the same thing with the test data. Okay, so these are copied, and we can just like check as well whether it was actually copied. So user, let's refresh just in case, HTTP, and here test data, and here we have our data. So the next step would be generating a descriptive file. And why would we need a descriptive file? Well, let's just have a look at what the data actually contains. So we see that there are a lot of there's a lot of information, a lot of columns, all separated by comma, but we don't actually know whether this is supposed to be a string zero or numerical zero or a category, and so on and so forth. So we have to first generate a descriptive file where we actually know which column is supposed to be what, which also could be done in Azure Machine Learning by using the metadata editor. So typical of a cooking show, I've prepared a script. Let me first execute this and then explain this one. So what it does is actually executing some jar files. In this case, it is one specific jar file. It's this one, a Mahout jar file. And then using or executing some class called describe.java, I can show you later on as well. And then here are some parameters as well. So first of all, this is supposed to be then the training data itself. Then we want to generate the descriptor file, and we'll save it on this file. And then I think, well, most importantly, actually describing each column. So it says the first three columns are supposed to be numerical, hence the N. Then the following two columns are supposed to be categorical, and so on and so forth. And the final one being L, meaning the label that we actually want to predict according to the data. It executed fine. Just taking a short step back, I was saying that Mahout is by default on HD Insight, so you can actually see this in the file explorer itself. So you go on C and then apps and then dist, and can see here a couple of components that is included on HD Insight, most importantly being the one here, Mahout. And then you can see that, in this case, we have executed this jar file in particular, this one here. If you want to know like what actually is contained in all those Mahout classes, you can have, it's all publicly available on GitHub. So here you can easily have access to that one and, have a look at what each parameter means and so on and so forth, and obviously write your own code on top of that one. So we have generated a descriptor file, which you can find in the directory of user HTTP, just the last one being here. And then the next step would be actually building a forest model. So going back here, for building the forest model, we will execute this jar file. So here, just going into the parameters that I've actually set. So the first one being like, okay, how big is the leaf size? So how many data rows am I allowing in each leaf of a random tree? The next one being, okay, which data set am I using? So what is the training data set? What is the descriptor file itself, this one? And then here, selection five, meaning, okay, how many variables am I using as I'm splitting each leaf to more branches. This one is specifying which implementation I'm using. So this is the partial implementation. Here, how many trees I'm using, and then finally, where am I actually saving the forest model? So yeah, it's still running here. In the meantime, so this would be the classes that we are actually using in this demo specifically. So here, build forest, for instance, here are the parameters specified as well if you want to have a look. And yeah, we can see that it has created or is storing the forest in this file in specifically. So let's have another look. Which is just here in user HTTP NSL forest as specified beforehand. Okay. And then finally, we want to classify the testing data or the unknown data, or check how accurate our built forest actually is. So as it is executing, let's go into more detail what the script actually says. So here we are using, obviously, okay, specifying what is the input data, then followed by what is the descriptor file, because the descriptor file is supposed to apply to the same testing data anyways. And then finally, where is the forest saved? A for actually analyzing all, well, giving some evaluation metrics in the end as well, such as accuracy, precision, and so on and so forth. Here, it's specifying that we are using the MapReduce implementation. It's optional, but MapReduce implementation meaning we are actually making use of Hadoop, of the fact that it is distributed and processing in parallel to each other. And finally, where are we saving the predictions? Yeah, so it's...
looks like it's done.
Yeah, it's done, pretty much, yeah. So here we can see, 1 second. Here we can see what the correctly classified instances and so on and so forth. Very nicely done as well is the confusion matrix and then the typical evaluation matrix that one uses in machine learning. So what did it actually output? We can go to where it is supposed to output, and here you can see that there's a new user listed, Olivia, because while I'm logged in onto the HD Insight cluster as a remote user called Olivia, and there it is actually stored just here. We can have a closer look.
Select all.
Okay, well, so it actually outputs whether it's an anomaly or normal, so either one or zero, so it's a binary classification in the end. So, 1 second. So here again, you can see the, okay, why doesn't it show anything? Ah, okay. Here again, like showing it in a nicer way of a confusion matrix, and then on the other side, some other statistic measures such as accuracy and reliability. So this was the output, and if you want to have more information on how to use Mahout on HD Insight, here's the website, and yeah, going on to the next, to the last section, validation.
Yeah, so we made a couple of decisions already. We made decision on tooling, we made decision how we write the query, how we analyze our data, but as you know, in the practice, very often what happens is you need to validate it and make sure what, for example, you can ensure that if the workload grows, you still get decent performance and et cetera. So therefore, remembering from classical building solution examples, there are three things what you really worry about always. It is performance, like whether you get everything out of your resources, whether it's executed correctly, and all the data what you push into the query tree, for example, gets executed. Scalability, what if you get more data? Like if your data inputs grow significantly, it's one thing to measure it in a kind of test environment, another if you run the real production there. And manageability. Like in case of platform as a service, it takes care of itself, right? But there are still some number of things you need to take care of and monitor, like what your storage count is doing, how data gets transferred there, and how like partitioning storage, etc. So monitoring consists of two parts. You need to monitor compute, and you need to monitor I/O. I/O, if you store data in HDFS, like we discussed the VM scenario, HDFS. Per box, you have 16 terabyte of space, which is cool. In the blob, you get no limits, basically. You can grow your number of blobs as much as you want. Cool, but we know what Azure I/O performance is not the same what you see on the box, right? So therefore, you need to think about how do you troubleshoot the situation if your storage is not providing sufficient power, right? And example here is we saw in this recommender engine the situation where at some stage we were coming to execution of one particular peak job, so all the data were landed in the HD inside, the peak was starting, and we saw what after running 4 hours, job was simply dying, right? Big problem. How do we analyze it? So we looked into the plan, and you need to know if you're not familiar with peak. Peak is similar to SQL Server, can generate the plan, and it has both logical and the physical plan. So, and from the plan, you may learn a lot about how your query gets executed, whether it's using parallelism or not, and et cetera, et cetera. And in our case, if what we observed, what at the end, after we were executing all the query nicely in parallel, the output was merging together on the single node. So out of these 75 nodes, just one was executing. Right, and this is where the 4 hours coming from. Right, then I think I just went too far. Yeah, so how can you get the information about what's going on your configuration? In HD Insight, you can log in only into the main node and access your configuration files as well as the log files, which is cool, but you cannot see what happens on each individual node there. It's just not supported, right? So what that means, how you troubleshoot, you go generate RDP session, and you need to know where the UZI collects the logs, where the peak collects the logs, and kind of correlate events in both of them together. So the another thing is the storage analytics, and I will try to demonstrate quickly how it works. So if you go to the blob storage in the Windows Azure subscription, like in my case, it's ADF data feeds, right? And you go, you can land in the configure dashboard, and here you see the blobs. I set it up typically by default, it is off. And I just enable it and set verbose. Now, if we go to some tools which can access blob storage, you see the same blob, and now I'm looking into analytics, and you get here a lot of events like list blob, delete blobs, get blob, and etc. This is pretty much comprehensive login there. And which button do I press to get back? Okay. So there are four types of information which we're logging in the storage count. First, related to application, availability of application, the latency end-to-end, and et cetera. There's important information that we also track called throttling. Throttling means what we cannot accept any more load from somebody who is asking, like in our case, it could be HD Insight. And we see the timestamp, and we see the data exchange ratio. We basically see all the ingress and egress of the data into storage count. So based on the data which I show you, you can build like that nice analytics, like what was happening and how many events happening and et cetera. So some analytics there. Why is this important? Because we saw, as we analyzed the log of the storage analytics there, we saw there was some high latency event there. And we looked at the timestamp and then looked into the UZI execution log. We saw that nearly at the same time, or in the same time range, there was Cutting of the connection to the Uzi. Basically what happened, the blob storage, when the Uzi started to execute pig job, the HD Insight put a lock on the blob so that it's not changing. So, and then there was something calculating on the background. And lock was there. It was still keeping calculating. The lock was there. Then blob storage waited enough and said, you know, guys, I cannot keep it so long. I cut the connection because I think the client was dead. So that's the thing. So the way to optimize it is was to look at the query, rewrite it in the way what there is more parallelism used. Another thing, if you look at the original query, it was like about 6 pages long. What we did instead, we cut this query into pieces which were executed individually and calling each other. Like once a smaller pass was executed, we were switching to another, etc. So we managed to avoid the situation when HD Insight computes something, but blob doesn't know about that and kills your connection. So this type of the analytics you need to run, and troubleshooting patterns. And wrapping up all the stuff what we saw here, maybe you do it for me.
Well,
sorry.
obviously with the first question, you first have to recognize the actual big data need. And then with like which platform, we've mostly talked about Hadoop on Azure as a like infrastructure as a service, which would be an option if you have a lot of dependency on open source software. Whereas, like, if you start a new project, the recommendation would be to go for HD Insight just because there's no need for infrastructure skills and you can just easily deploy a Hadoop cluster really quickly. Where would you store your data? Well, obviously, in our case, or in the case of HD Insight, blob storage is the most preferred option. And then you can easily scale out by using multiple storage accounts. For pre-processing your data, you can use many tools such as Pig, Hive, and then obviously you always take into account which one would perform better or scale better. If you have a very strong SQL background, the recommendation would be to go for Hive just because it's a very SQL-like language. For analyzing your data, well, you have Mahout, Azure Machine Learning, and so on and so forth. And then finally, with validating your solution, just note that most solution actually is comprised of many little components, and just validating the performance of each component is not enough. It's also validating how each of those components actually interact with each other.
So I think with that we've done with our session. There are a couple of mandatory slides here to show like related content. To remind you what there is also Ask the Expert session right after this track. And you're welcome coming there, asking your question. We've got few minutes if you have questions on what we told you just. So feel free asking questions. There's a question here.
Just what type of testing did you do to make sure that your analysis was correct?
Sorry, could
what, you... What type of testing did you do? I mean, how did you validate whether or not what you're doing was correct?
So at the end, when we build solution, the question is what type of testing we did to prove if our architecture was correct. So what we did is we developed the test harness, which was simulating end-to-end solution. Basically, what first of all this automated deployment, so we wanted to validate whether it runs from beginning to the end without a failure, so from first step to the last one. And since we've got already existing data, what the customer did is just run on a decent, like a daily amount of data to calculate, took it as example, and to calculate the speed, how fast we are completing all the steps. So in our case, it was not necessarily to imitate like a customer, random customer load and et cetera, because the workflow is identical every day. It's not changing much, right? So, but this is the approach, two things. Deployment, automated deployment from beginning to the end, and the successful query execution and the timing. Because all the steps, they had the SLAs, like how fast you have to produce the similarity matrix and et cetera, it has some SLAs.
I want to go back to the start of the presentation and like to again understand based on what did you qualify the two problems to be a big data problems. Again, for me, big data means volume, variety, velocity. So for the car manufacturing, it was an offline process. It's not running online. So probably it's a massive data, but it's only offline. So there is no volume, so there's no velocity, and there's no variety. And for the e-commerce, I don't think it's a lot of data. I mean, this data, every time a user logs in, but it, I think can be done using a powerful SQL server of some sort.
Well, it's a good question. So the question basically is for the e-commerce, it doesn't seem to be a lot of data. And the other question was, the other part of the question was the variety of the data was not very observed. So speaking of the e-commerce platform, they generate a couple of hundreds of gigabytes per day in the IIS logs. And this is actually not the biggest problem, but the thing is, if you want to run prediction and you want to make it more precise, you need to invoke a lot of data in there. The more data you have, the better for your analytics. Therefore, currently guys have around about like 20, 30 terabyte of data collected in less than 1 year. So therefore, I would say it's pretty much impressive. And speaking of the car manufacturer, they are storing about 5 years worth of data, and it's about 100 terabyte already. And speaking of the variety, as I told you, the variety comes from this differences in what type of sensors, what types of the formats you have inside of this XML form, right? Therefore, it's every time like opening the Christmas box, you never know what to expect. It's not standardized. It's very difficult to retrieve the information. So therefore, I agree in this particular case, it's on the edge between classical data warehouse problem where you will waste a lot of effort on doing appropriate ETL, or rather you store the data and you do like we did in this case, we did our own crawler who knew a couple of patterns and was extracting data we needed for this type of analytics. Yeah. There was one more question there at the end.
Great session, Olivia and Alexei. I just had a couple of questions there. One, how do you error handle within HD Insight? Let's say you get data files coming in, you're firing in Hive queries, you're adding structure to the data that is unstructured. Now, when those files come in with undue columns or let's say undue data types, how do you error handle them? And the second one is, a little earlier in the session, Olivia mentioned she was storing all her tweets in single tweets as JSON files. Didn't you run into the small file problem with big data?
Yeah.
Were those even picked up at all?
So could you repeat the last part again?
Were those individual tweet files picked up at all while processing? I mean, if you hit the small file problem, those JSON files would be like, I don't know, 1 KB, 2 KB, 3 KB in size. They won't even be picked up by the Hadoop processes to be kind of taken into consideration while bringing in the Hive tables or pig scripts, etc.
So in our case, when we just ran the validation of the solution, we decided not to look into whether the files will be picked up at all or not. We broke the process after a few hours of waiting, right? And then contacted a couple of guys, like ask for like how to resolve it, and we got the hint of merging files into the bigger ones so that we don't have this problem. So for us, it was more efficient to resolve the issue rather than investigating what is happening in the background, right? Yeah, the error validation part is the very tricky part. As you know, like if For example, if the data corrupted, classical data warehouse an issue, if the data corrupted when they come in, so what do you do about that? Are there any patterns how you can recognize it? It's the same difficult issue with Hadoop as well, first of all. So you cannot see if data consistent or not consistent, right? But then if through the Hive processing, for example, or peak processing execution, something fails, well, welcome to the open source world, because troubleshooting of this is pretty much painful, and you need to know where in the logs you have to look for the errors, how to correlate those errors together, and et cetera. It was also part of the education we had to go through. Like I mentioned at the end here, this peak query troubleshooting was pretty much nice challenge until we were able to associate the OOSI job fail with the peak job fail with the storage count problem. So therefore, I don't know if it answers your question, but troubleshooting errors in Hadoop is kind of challenge on itself.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Then thank you guys for coming and listening. Hope it helped you a little bit with adopting these new technologies, and then welcome to the Ask the Expert session. So, unless you have other plans.